proudly student and listener supported community radio. CIUT 89.5 FM, celebrating 35 years as the sound of your city.
About, there's really very dramatic news. The Colombia has a new president, and he is a socialist, and his vice president is the first black woman vice president of Colombia, someone, I would say, perhaps even to the left of the president. It's a dramatic moment. Just for our listeners to think about, the new president, Mr. Petro, has said that they're going to improve relations and begin regular trade with Venezuela and further isolating Canada. Apparently, they do not believe that Mr. Guaido is the president. They recognize President Maduro is the president. This is very important news. And on the news front, I want to make sure I say before we get to Robin that there is an important event coming up. There are across Canada, and I suspect the United States, there are protests against the North Atlantic Treaty Organization. There will be a rally in Hamilton on Saturday, June 25th. Saturday, June 25th, from 1 to 2 p.m. in front of Jackson Square at King and James Street, rain or shine. And they're asking people to bring Canada out of NATO signs. There are many signs that NATO is experiencing problems within. Some months back, everybody said that this matter in Ukraine was going to unite NATO. There's evidence that the opposite is starting to happen. But we'll go into that later. But again, Hamilton Rally, Saturday, June 25. 1 to 2 p.m., Jackson Square, King and James Street. Now I think we have with us Robin Philpott. Are you there, Robin?
Yes. Hi, Phil. I'm here.
Thanks a lot for joining us and for your patience. We have interesting unfolding, I guess, events. NATO is going to be meeting in Madrid soon, and the Commonwealth is meeting heads of state, but I guess the meeting's open today in Kigali, Rwanda. And Rwanda joined the Commonwealth in 2009, and now they are hosting, and the president of Rwanda, Paul Kagame, will be the head of, I think the titular head is a good term for it, of the Commonwealth for one year. But this has shocked a few people. The Globe and Mail, just to set this parameters to what we're going to be talking about, the Globe and Mail, of all journals, said there's quite a bit of skepticism and irony among being spoken about amongst attendees and people of the countries of the Commonwealth, because they're looking to have a resolution on Ukraine that would be condemning the Russian special military operation, as it's been called. At the same time, says the Globe, Paul Kagame is being singled out and noted even by U.S. government for once again going into Congo, including there's a group there called the M23. The names always seem to change, but Paul Kagame always seems to have something going on in his neighbor's country. He's invaded it twice, and the Globe thought that ought to be, I suppose, it's something that Justin Trudeau was talking about. However, there's no sign of that. That's a long introduction. But Robin, I want to know, when you see this unfolding, what kind of what thoughts do you have about the prominence of the government of Rwanda in the eyes of Paris, New York, and London?
Yeah, I'm glad you included New York because the U.S. is not a member of the Commonwealth. And we have to remember that, except it's probably the most powerful country in the Commonwealth. In other words, the way I see it is the Commonwealth is, you might call, an extension of the United States, NATO. At least it wants to be that extension. It's an extension of basically the Anglo-American world, you know, which is, as you've often pointed out, in the intelligence circles, is represented by the Five Eyes. And so even though New York is not present, they are very present in that they are defining the policies there. So I'm glad to hear the Globe and Mail is wondering whether Trudeau is going to speak about invading the Congo. We might say also that Kagame is probably one of the only places in Africa where people can go and hope to get a resolution against Russia adopted. I mean, Kagame is out of step with the African Union. The African Union has been to Moscow and has not gotten involved in these sanctions. So that it's almost like saying Kagame is being the extension of NATO in Africa.
Yeah, by the way, I should raise there that it isn't, I don't think it's a done deal that they're going to get this resolution, because I understand some African states that will be attending don't agree with the idea of, as a matter of fact, I just read today in a British paper that one of the attending states, they didn't mention the head of the delegation, but he said, actually, we're not supposed to be addressing matters outside, as African states, we're not supposed to get involved in matters elsewhere in Europe.
Yeah.
And there seem to be, by the way, if there's a consensus, it's on that point in Africa.
Right.
Because go ahead. I'm sorry.
Yeah. No. But if they would hope to get it by using Kagame, but Kagame is isolated on this question, and perhaps on other questions as well, except it's almost like it's a last-ditch attempt by this Commonwealth organization, which is an extension of basically the Anglo-American world. In other words, they don't have a lot of ground to stand on in Africa right now because of the position that the African Union has taken. And so there's been a lot of people concerned among the Rwandan community, and I understandably, like, here we go there, and the Commonwealth goes there, and they're supposed to be talking about human rights, and they say, well, this man has been one of the principal violators of human rights in Africa for the last 30 years, if almost, like, close to 30 years. I mean, he's more than that, since it began with the invasion of Rwanda via Uganda in 1990. But I think that and I say this in a fraternal manner with our Rwandan friends, we have to see it as being the people who have gone there are the ones who basically have been backing him while he's done this over the last 28 years, Kagame. In other words, every time he violates the human rights of Rwandans, be they within Rwanda or in neighboring countries or in South Africa or here, we might get to this, here in Canada, they're doing it at the behest of the United States, of Canada, of England, and more recently of France. If we want to protect the human rights of Rwanda and Africans in general, we have to go after those who are organized this kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. We're speaking to Robin Philpott, Baraka Books. By the way, Robin Philpott has written one of the most respected accounts of the events of 1994 and their broader implications, involvement with both colonialism and what we probably we need to emphasize more these days, neo-colonialism. Right. Look at the relationship between Boris Johnson, pretty much worldwide recognized as a somewhat inferior version of a prime minister, and he has this magical plan to deal with African asylum seekers by sending them to Rwanda. I can't think of another any African state which would cooperate, but Kagame does. I mean, and that phase of it, it looks to me very much like the old colonialism. You have Africans who are seeking asylum in Britain, and they say, "Oh well, we don't want them here." So, but we're not opposed to their seeking asylum. So we'll put them on a plane, send them to Kigali, and they can apply from there. And then Rwanda, we will give Rwanda money to look after these Africans. And then they, being colonialists, they say Africa is one country, when in fact it's 50-some-odd countries, very different cultures, histories. But it's just like, oh, there's a Rwanda basket. We just take the asylum seekers. And that, by the way, is not a, just, you know, sort of a wild idea. It was, it's on the point of being carried out, and they have created actually a kind of a conundrum. As I understand it, the only thing preventing it going forward at the moment is a commitment to the European Union that they would follow the policies regarding asylum seekers, immigration, whatnot, until Britain is completely out of the EU, which would then permit it to do anything, of course, it wanted. And some are angry that the EU still has any say in what happens with British policy.
Right, exactly.
That's a nightmare.
Let me just say, you know, it is kind of a very special situation. You had the Commonwealth. And now the head of the Commonwealth for a year is going to be the president of Rwanda, Paul Kagame. Then you have this organization called l'Organisation Internationale de la Francophonie, Sommet de la Francophonie. You know, it's a Francophone country, and which was founded, was an idea spawned by General de Gaulle in 1966, and the president of Senegal, Leopold Senghor. And their goal in the 60s was to create a pole that was out of the domination of the Anglo-American axis, which included Canada, of course. They wanted to be able to have oxygen. That was the word that was used. And Quebec was going to be part of it. And so they set this organization up. By the way, Trudeau's father fought tooth and nail against it. And so it was only in 1986 that the French this organization was founded. But the situation is such that now the person who heads that organization is the former Minister of Foreign Affairs of Rwanda, Louise Mushikiwabo. And so It just shows that people talk about how important it is to have a multipolar world. Well, this is how you have a single pole under the leadership of the United States. That's what they're operating on. Even so, the United States is not a member of that organization either, because it's not a French speaking country.
So it's a silent partner.
Yeah, it's a silent. That's a nice way of saying it.
You know they're out there because funny things happen in the night to people who don't like it.
Yeah, exactly. So it is you want also once again say that these are last ditch attempts of a declining empire. I mean, they want to control, and the only person they can have real control over is Rwanda now, at this today, they have a limited number of countries that they can really count on. That was the reason when it wasn't in the title of my book, Rwanda and the New Scramble for Africa, because Rwanda was going to be the agent.
Yes. By the way, anybody who doubts it should read or look at the speeches of Christopher, Warren Christopher, I guess his name was, who was the foreign minister, I'm going to call him, Secretary of State, under Bill Clinton. And he traveled right just after the RPF seized power in 1994, and it was a seizure of power, military seizure. He began to say that it was time for France to get out of Africa and stop behaving like a colonial power. And he gave speech after speech saying that. And he went to Zaire, where he said it. And just to underline, I want to ask you to talk about this. The Louise Mushikiwabo, she was, of course, part of forming the new government in 1994. And they immediately said that in a country which speaks Kinyarwanda, that's the language of the country, actually. If you get outside Kigali, they speak that. They also, their second language, particularly in education, is French. Certainly all the government leaders, church leaders, everyone spoke French. They announced that English was now going to be the official language. So they fought for that. By the way, people invoke the word genocide a lot, and I don't like to overdo it. But certainly one of the points about genocide is that if you take somebody's language, you know, by a state and just say, well, you're speaking French, but now we're going to speak English. You know, you are disrupting their lives utterly. And that's what they knew what they were doing when they did that. And that, so here is a government that said if English is going to be the official language, the second language, and she gets elected president now, some 20 years later, of the Francophonie.
And it was France, basically.
And France agreed, loved it.
France is the one who pushed it. And France pushed it, and it was the Americans who insisted on that being done. I mean, the France wanted to get along and do that, but it just shows you that what de Gaulle represented and Senghor in those days, where you wanted to talk about the multipolar world, France has just completely surrendered and is on its knees in front of the U.S. And so, this Commonwealth and the Francophone Summit. Now are just they are just there for the advancement of the Anglo-American alliance.
There's a Canadian angle to it too that is often forgotten about, and it's because the Globe and the Star and the CBC want us to forget, and certainly the government wants us to forget that the president of the Francophonie was her name Jean-Michel.
Michelle Jean.
And Canada was so proud that she had become the leader of the Francophonie. But when they put up Louise Mushikiwabo from Rwanda, Canada stopped supporting our own representative at the Francophonie. She was defeated in an election in which the Canadian government did not support her.
They
talk about being a running dog. I don't know what
running dog.
Canada, for crying out loud, pull up your trousers and put on your hat. This is ridiculous.
So, but anyway, it is. I think it's a telling story to see them be in such a situation that they Rwanda becomes so important for them. In other words, they used to be able to count on Senegal, Mali, West African countries, and now they can't count on them. I mean, the president of Senegal went to Moscow. He was president. He is the current president of the African Union. He went to Moscow, and they were not going to get involved in the sanctions. So the countries that were used to be at their beck and call are just not there now. Yeah. In some ways, you could say this is a good development. I think we can say this is a very good development. I heard you talking about what's going on in Colombia. It seems to me...
It's becoming unanimous.
Right, exactly.
I mean, Colombia... you would know. I mean, a year, what was it, 2 years, 3 years ago, Chrystia Freeland, all the big, some top rock stars and billionaires went to the border of Venezuela as though they were going to deliver food and whatever. They were, it was basically like an invasion from Colombia. And the Colombian government was, you know, permitting that. It was a provocation on the Venezuelan border, almost looked like a war. Yeah. And now it has flipped over, and there is a new government that is saying they're going to resume relations with Venezuela. And they're not party to the, I can't even remember, what was it called, the Lima Group?
Yeah.
With Chrystia Freeland and Bolsonaro, or whoever his name is. They were going to isolate and destroy the Venezuelan government.
Right.
You know, we can't get any Canadian politicians to talk about this. This is embarrassing.
Right. Yeah, sure it is. And Guaido is still, they're still saying he is the, I saw something on Twitter not long ago, where the Canadian, the foreign affairs minister, global affairs as they call it, was still supporting Guaido, not two or three weeks ago.
Yes. The last time I saw Guaido, he was in a fist fight in a bar. Somebody put it up that he came into a shishi bar in Caracas, but the right-wing groups don't like him anymore because he's a flop, and they think it's partly him, and also, as you know, some money disappeared, but he didn't. So he walked into, it sounds like a comedian's thing, he walked into a bar in Caracas, and somebody filmed a group of people starting to throw chairs at him, saying, "We don't want you here." Maybe he should call Chrystia Freeland and say, "I'm a little bit of trouble here. Could you send the RCMP or somebody?"
Anyway, it is a very a telling situation. I mean, I think we'll have to look at it carefully, but it shows in so many ways the weakness of the Anglosphere, that they put all their eggs in the Rwandan basket.
Yes, it's almost, it appears somewhat desperate. This is Robin Philpott, Baraka Books. By the way, read Robin's book. Robin, give your title again of the book.
It's called Rwanda and the New Scramble for Africa. From Tragedy to Useful Imperial Fiction. Anyway, the Luis Musakawabo is also linked to the other thing you wanted to talk about, the other issue about the funeral for Jerome Bichpanpaka.
Yes, I wanted to mention that. If you don't mind, I'll just say that Jerome Bichimumpaka, we've spoken to Robin Philpott about this previously, but just to remind you, he was representing the Rwandan government at the United Nations Security Council in the summer of 1994, and he was calling for the UN to do its duty and bring a ceasefire and end the massacre of civilians in his country. And for his efforts, he was nearly arrested by American authorities on the say-so of the Human Rights Watch, who, at any rate, it's a terrible story. He ended up accused at the International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda. And and acquitted, and lost many years of his life, and his family, of course, suffered tremendously. But they, the core of the family are Canadian citizens, outstanding people who've really contributed to the community, and they've maintained, of course, the honor of their father, Jerome Bichimapaka, who died in Nairobi. And they, Canadian citizens, asked that he be permitted to come to Canada since he was a free man and had been acquitted of all charges. But that was not possible. Instead, he died.
He died.
But his remains were brought So, right. And you were at the ceremony, Robin. So tell us about this.
I will definitely. By the way, Jerome wrote a special text in the edition of my book I just mentioned, where he describes what happened to him when he was at New York, pleading for a ceasefire, a strengthened UN forces so they could put an end to the killing. And he wrote this text for me, and we were able to communicate back in 2013 when he was supposedly a free man. He'd been acquitted in 2010. And as you said, 23 years of his life were stolen from him by the international criminal justice. They were stolen from him. He was arrested by Louis Arbour the 6th of April, 1999. And he was acquitted 12 years later. And 11,
yes.
yeah, 11
96,
years later.
96, 97.
No, he was arrested in 99.
Oh, 99. I'm sorry. I thought I heard you say 91. I actually was in the building when they brought him in, actually.
Oh, my God. Anyway, the 6th of April by Louis Zabour, who was then prosecutor, and he died the 19th of May, 2022, and he had never been allowed to join his family, despite he had been wrongly accused and was acquitted of everything. But there was a very important funeral last Saturday, you know, 9 days ago. Saturday, the 11th of June, and people had come from all over the world. It was organized by his family. There were relatives, friends, people came from the States, Belgium, other places from Western Canada were family, and there were hundreds and hundreds of people. It was held at the Notre Dame Basilica, which is where a lot of important people have had their celebrations, the lives have been celebrated following their death, including René Lévesque in 87, Trudeau in 2000.
Pierre Trudeau and Fidel Castro attended Trudeau's funeral.
Yeah, and so they traveled to the family to having decided to go there because for 11 years after he was acquitted, they requested that Canada apply their own rules of the uniting family and respect the decision of the tribunal that they had helped set up and had helped finance, and because this man had been wrongly accused and was totally acquitted, and Canada constantly refused to allow him to come to join his family. And we can say that if the man died at the age of 64, going on 65, Canada has bears responsibility for that death.
Injustice. His life was, and of course, he is representative of a number of other acquitted people who have not been able to return to their families.
Yeah, and they've just been said that they've
been acquitted.
Yeah, acquitted and free. And even in his case, judge was blamed, made a severe criticism of the prosecution for hiding disculpatory evidence, which, it's irrefutable evidence that the man was innocent of the charges laid against him. In other words, it was a pure acquittal and also an attack on the prosecution. Now, he was never allowed to join his family, and they tried all kinds of ways, all kinds of pressure they put on it. And two people could have changed that around with just a silent phone call to Bill, and who are people who have been made into saints in Canada, Louis Arbour, who was responsible for arresting as prosecutor. And she could have phoned and said, listen, this man was innocent, acquitted. You have to respect the decision of the courts we supported. She did. She remained totally silent. And Romeo Belair, who met Jerome, and Jerome was foreign affairs minister, and he met Jerome on the 11th of April, 1994, when all the so that we know later what's happening. And he insisted that the UNAMIR, the United Nations, provide stronger forces and that a ceasefire be applied. In other words, at that meeting. And so Romeo Dallaire could easily have phoned, and he wouldn't even have to make it public, to say this man has to be allowed to join his family because he's innocent. And they remained silent.
Yes. You know, that underlines something. That when Luisa Arbour was given the job after an interview with Madeleine Albright, who wanted to make sure that she was okay, she began to philosophize about what they were doing at the both with former Yugoslavia and Rwanda. And she, I was reading one of her speeches only a couple of days ago, at the beginning, and she said, "Well, Nuremberg, of course, was a victor's justice, whereas because it was the parties that had defeated Germany that organized the trial, and therefore it was victor's justice." And she said, "What we're doing is true international justice because we are not in involved, and we're just simply looking at criminal issues." And she said, "Then that makes that's why this is we're going to set an example of proper justice." And and as you point out, her court, with her the prosecutor, I mean, and Jerome Bichimapaka is acquitted, and then he's treated like he was guilty.
Yeah.
So it looks like sounds like victor's justice.
Yeah, and he.
Why didn't
they
pat him on the back and say, "Well, you see, it works."
And they tried to, he remained in Arusha. He couldn't go anywhere. They wanted to get him to go to Niger, but he was having health problems. And then he was all by himself. And he became very despondent, very depressed by it. And then he was in another hospital, another hospital, and he picked up some of these bacteria, which. And you could say that was that bacteria and others were the cause of his death. But had he been reunited with his family when he was acquitted, there is a chance that he would still be alive with us. Yeah. In other words, there's a serious responsibility that has to be examined on this question.
Why didn't people act the way courts are supposed to act? If someone's acquitted in Toronto, he goes home.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
And by the way, these are not Rwandans who are denying him. I mean, Rwanda would be happy to deny him. They would like to put him in prison if he is still alive.
Yeah.
But they said this is an international court. So on what grounds do they deny him the chance to return, be in the, with his family of Canadian citizens?
Right.
And speaking of which, can you tell me, his widow spoke and others... What sort of things were said there by?
Including the priest, by the way. He talked about the injustice that he was a victim of, but his spouse made it very clear that the struggle is not over with his departure. The struggle is not over. It's an incomplete struggle. In other words, they want justice. Mm-hmm. And even if the man has passed away, because there are other cases, there was mention of Niger, of the eight people in Niger, and the fact that Canada refused to allow them is for them, was they made it very clear, this is scandal. So did the lawyer, a Montreal lawyer by the name of Philippe La Rochelle, spoke at the reception and made it clear that Canada's behavior was despicable.
Mm-hmm.
Despicable about it, and as the court itself was a despicable act of injustice, made it very clear. So it was not a, in a sense, it was an upbeat funeral. People were very upset about his leaving because he was young and he was healthy. He never had any sickness in his life. By the way, you mentioned Canada, but Belgium and France also refused because he had family in Belgium and France. So that it's almost as if they all passed the word that you're not letting any of these people in. But that's
no, they collude.
Yeah.
And Britain at the forefront saying, no, we put Africans in Africa.
Yeah.
And he's apparently an African, so he goes to Africa. It raises really the specter of the opening remarks by President Kagame. Now I suddenly can't say the name of the president of the International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda, but he opened by saying, because reporters were there and they said for the opening days, and they said, why is this tribunal here? Because, you know, it's very difficult for us to cover this, the major news outlets of the world, because, you know, and you do have The Hague, where you have International Criminal Court. Why isn't the trial being held at The Hague? And Judge Kama said it was for social and cultural reasons that they would be tried in Africa. And I don't know why people thought that sounded reasonable, because, you know, when I flew from Dar es Salaam to Schiphol Airport in Netherlands, when you get off the plane, the Europeans, white people, tend to go up the ramp and meet their friends and go home. But at the top of the ramp, there are people standing in uniforms and whatnot, and they tend to pick out people to talk to and about who they are, where they're going. And it's clear that they're Africans. The easiest thing to see is say, oh, there's a little lineup of people. And that's what I call social and cultural reasons. They're separating. And I don't know what they think. They weren't hiding that. And so here you have a situation where a highly educated man who represented his country quite nobly and took a lot of grief. But if you read what he had to say, who could argue with it? He said, we need a ceasefire and we need a more UN presence to end the war and the killing of civilians. He said all that. And he was browbeaten. and pursued like a lot of outstanding people.
Right. And you know, and to his death. And that is where, you know, they don't play around. You know, it's like the man's free, but you just let him die. And then that's, you know, anyway, it's absolutely a scandalous. But the Rwandan community, and we're talking about hundreds and hundreds of people, working close to 1,000, there was a big reception after where people spoke, and everybody was saying the truth is on our side. Truth will be out. You know, truth will come out about the history of Africa and the Rwanda crisis. Every one of these families, every one of these people, the Rwandans who were there, they all have stories which are similar, maybe not as serious as the case of Jerome Bichimampaka, but they feel it right to their heart, you know, about how bad the injustice has been.
Yeah, well, it does. It's certainly hopeful. I would say he is such an attractive, emblematic figure to understand what happened in 90, what happened in 94, and then what happened at the tribunal, and the ongoing rationale for primarily Western colonial, neocolonial powers to embrace him and see to it, and that that he has, they're in charge of his longevity. I suppose we should take some heart from the fact that there's clear signs that because of the heavy conflict between major powers once again in Europe, that developing countries are looking on this as saying Europe can't get its act together. Europe has no business telling us what to do, and they will make their own decisions.
Right.
It seems to be turbulence, not just in Europe, but turbulence in Africa. But you pointed out the African Union said, we're not going to get involved in this, and we're not going to sanction anybody. So Canada and U.S. can go waive sanctions, but they're not going to do it.
Yeah,
so,
exactly.
But I really like the fact that you point out that the Commonwealth, by doing this, is trying to put its foot back in. It's like using the old expression, a cat's paw.
Right.
To get in there.
Yeah, and the Francophone organization as well. They're both trying to use the same cat's paw.
Yes.
But you know,
but even Macron seems to be now on thin ice.
So, exactly.
He looked out his window this morning and saw clouds gathering.
Exactly.
And if those are clouds. It could turn into crowds. It does look very dicey in Europe. Well, Robin, it's been very enlightening. And we thank you very much. And our heart goes out to the Bichi Mumpaka family. I hope that they will put together the story of their father. And as Canadians, talking what happened to their dad and how Canada kind of let them down. And certainly African Canadians being let down.
Yeah, and the two, his two children, one is a doctor, the other is a manager, and they both spoke very well, very convinced about their father and the innocence, and so it is encouraging. They grew up here.
Mm-hmm.
They were at the age of 11 and 6 when the father was arrested.
Indeed.
Now, in the late 20s and 30s.
They've heard the Canadian speech about this is the land where freedom and whatnot is exercised, except in the case of their father.
Yeah, and they say it quite clearly, we are very, very disappointed by the country that we have adopted.
Yeah. Well, thanks again, Robin.
Okay.
Baraka Books, we really appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
Take it up. Bye-bye.
Bye. Have a good day.
Thank you. Taylor Report, CIUT. I think we have a little music, and we'll be back with some news from around the world.